Hello and welcome to Alchemy 101, the show where we explore the many paths of transformation and aim to mine a few nuggets of gold that can support us in living in line with nature in a way that's true to our nature, even though that might seem quite counterintuitive, like the nightingale singing out in the dark. Thank you for joining me today. I'm JJ, the Practical Alchemist, and I have a wonderful guest with me today who, I have to admit, blew my mind a bit as we delved into the positive effect sunlight has on our health. Nature, as ever, gives us everything we want, but first, just listen to this for a moment. How did that make you feel? It's relaxing, isn't it? And according to a study by Southwestern Railways of all people, that's what you should be listening to when you commute, instead of music or talk, even UK Health Radio, dare I say. The study that was led by Charles Spence, who's a professor of experimental psychology at the University of Oxford, found that listening to nature soundscapes like this reduced stress levels amongst commuters by 38% and reduced nervousness by 32%. By comparison, those listening to music or podcasts only registered an 11% reduction in stress. Nature always knows best, doesn't it? I'm sure today's guest would agree. Dr. Max Goulhain is a medical doctor, a GP registrar, and a decentralised health educator. He believes in giving us the tools that we need to live our most optimal, healthy life. And what he has to say about our exposure to sunlight might surprise you. But this is a man who walks his talk, and when I spoke to him at his home in Australia, it was evening and dark, and he was shrouded in red light. For a purpose. It's all about circadian rhythms. So right off the bat, I asked him to explain.
Yeah, thanks, JJ. Look, the reason is simply because light and the different types of light affect our bodies in different ways. And our bodies essentially have developed over millions of years, and prior to even humans existing, prior to our current form as mammals and as primates, even as far back as eukaryotic and even prokaryotic life, the different light frequencies and have influenced how life operates. And essentially, the light of daytime, which is a whole different smorgasbord of colors, both in the visible and non-visible, it's in the midday is predominantly has a strong blue component, and that tells us that it's daytime. And towards the end of the day, in evening, and as the solar day is ending and the sun's setting, the proportion of blue becomes less, and red and infrared light predominates. So that signal that it sends to the body is that, you know, it's time to wind down, it's time to go to sleep. The problem that everyone in the modern day is facing is that for various reasons, including government energy saving mandates, that we now are illuminating our indoor spaces with lighting that is mimicking or sending a midday signal to our eyes and to our skin. And that is profoundly harmful with regard to the light signals that our body is expecting to receive. And what that does is it essentially turns off the production of a very important hormone called melatonin that we need to fall asleep and to stay asleep. So the red light after dark is one way of mitigation of to still be able to, you know, do this interview and chat to you, JJ, across the world, while minimizing the disruption to my circadian health, which is the kind of internal clock that regulates all these body functions and is predominantly influenced by the light in our environment and the light that's received by our eyes and our skin.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I love that you're actually not compromising by compromising your health when you're talking to me, because we should have said in Australia, and it's evening there or nighttime there, and I'm in the UK and it's morning. Now, talking about the work that you do, you call yourself a decentralized health educator. Now, what do you mean by that?
So I think the concept of decentralized health can be in many ways defined by its opposite. So what is centralized healthcare and what is centralized health? Well, it is the model of medicine and healthcare that is primarily centered around pharmaceutical management of chronic disease. And it's a model of healthcare that is almost completely ignoring the fundamental causes of chronic diseases. It's ignoring preventative behaviors or de-emphasizing effective preventative behaviors like our light environment, like our food, like our sleep quality, and all of these inputs that essentially will dictate whether or not we develop chronic diseases or not. And it focuses on waiting in essentially until patients have manifested a type 2 diabetes, they've manifested Alzheimer's dementia, they've manifested fatty liver, an autoimmune disease, a behavioral problem, autism spectrum disorder, etc. Take your pick of any one of these chronic diseases. And once that disease is manifested, centralized healthcare essentially directs people to a subspecialist, a specialist doctor, a heart doctor, a cardiologist, a kidney doctor, a renal physician, a neurologist, a psychiatrist, an immunologist, a pulmonary physician. Each one of these people is from in the centralized healthcare model is looking at that organ, that disease in an organ-specific way, and is usually prescribing a drug or a surgery that specifically targets the problem as they see it. And don't get me wrong, there's lots of value in subspecialty medicine, and especially with acute illnesses, say clot retrieval if you have a stroke, acute myocardial infarction, you need to be rushed to the cath lab and have some work done by the interventional cardiologist. Yes, incredibly valuable and incredibly important. But the issue that I'm interested in is chronic disease, because it's affecting so many people in our society today. And it's at essentially epidemic proportions. And I know that in the UK and in the NHS, your public health system is straining and almost breaking under the weight of chronic disease. And centralized health care has essentially been inadequate in terms of preventing these diseases. So that's a centralized approach. It's pharmaceutical driven, it's pharmaceutical emphasized, and really keeps people in a state of management of their chronic diseases rather than having any form of curative intent. So decentralized health, rather than relying on pharmaceutical-based treatment guidelines, which are unfortunately in this day and age are simply written by experts, say the esteemed professor of nephrology, who unfortunately, wittingly or unwittingly, gets funding and influence by the pharmaceutical industry. So it becomes a simple fact of conflicted interests that the medical curriculum, the guidelines that are written, are essentially become in many ways mouthpieces or extensions of a pharmaceutical company profit motive. And a lot of well-meaning clinicians aren't, again, necessarily intentionally doing this, but they're part of a system that simply is geared around this model. And it goes as far back as the peer review process and the way that science is conducted, because even the funding models of science today involve these financial conflicts of interest. And and it can be very difficult to generate unbiased scientific findings. So decentralized health and a decentralized medicine is one that essentially emphasizes preventative health by looking at the fundamental inputs into health, and it looks at evolutionary biology and essentially the niche that humans evolved in, and how natural phenomena like light cycles, like circadian signaling, influence health. And overwhelmingly, a decentralized health approach doesn't emphasize pharmaceutical drugs. It emphasizes these preventative health behaviors. It emphasizes all kinds of behaviors that essentially they're free, and a whole bunch of disease reversal can occur without the need of pharmaceutical interventions. And that is kind of the thrust of decentralized health. And at the core is things like circadian biology, a diet that is consistent with what our ancestors ate, and really minding our environmental inputs and essentially recreating those of our ancestral past before the invention of modern lighting and modern ultra-processed foods.
And then one of the things that I have been talking about recently, and that is sunlight and, you know, circadian rhythms, getting enough sleep. Now, I came to you because I saw something that you'd put up on YouTube, actually, about the sun and how important sunlight is for our health. Can we talk about that? Can you tell us more about that? Because I think too many people have been scared away from the sunlight.
Yes. Look, sunlight was an ever-present input into life on Earth. Life could not have evolved on planet Earth without the abundant amount of energy that solar radiation provides. And this is, it's so critical that when you cover an organism from the sun, it withers and dies. I mean, imagine if you took a tarpaulin and you put it over, you know, the orange tree growing in your garden. I mean, it's a simplistic analogy, but do you think it would grow oranges? The answer is no. And yes, plants are they photosynthesize, they have chlorophyll, and chloroplasts, and that's how they operate. But they're still eukaryotic organisms, and we have innovated as humans. We've innovated a whole bunch of biological semiconductors, and we've come up with a way to use this compound called melanin in our skin to harness massive amounts of energy from the sun and to run the incredibly energy intensive operations in our body. So sunlight is absolutely critical for human health, and it is critical in a range of ways that are indispensable. So some of your listeners might know about vitamin D, and vitamin D is a hormone that is only made in our body when we get exposed to ultraviolet B light. And what that means is only at a certain time of the day, and at your latitude in Scotland, at only certain times of the year is the sun high enough in the sky for that UV light to strike the earth. And when it is, it causes a chemical reaction in our body to generate this this vitamin, which is actually a hormone. And vitamin D, when it goes through its process of activation, is incredibly important for bone health. So much so that when children in the late 1800s and early 1900s lived in dense, foggy, smoggy cities like Glasgow and Poland and all throughout Europe, they actually got their legs became bowed, and they developed a disease called rickets, and that is severe vitamin D deficiency. So what they found is that exposing kids to a lamp that contained ultraviolet light was sufficient to improve this condition, rickets. And eventually we discovered that it was the sunlight wavelength that was critical for vitamin D production. But it turns out that it's not only important for bone health, but vitamin D is also important for our immune system function. It's important for our cancer defense. It's important for metabolic health. It's important for so many things. And that is only one of the myriad of functions that natural sunlight has. And I talked about UVB, but there's all UVA, there's infrared light, there's all these colors are visible that all have unique biological effects. It's probably appropriate to bring up a study, and that study was done by one of your countrymen, Professor Richard Weller, who is a dermatologist based in Edinburgh. And he is a researcher of the effect of sunlight on health. And in his profession, the dermatologists, they are possibly the most outspoken medical specialty against getting sun exposure. Yet he's a bit of a renegade, and the reason is because he looked at the data of people who got sun exposure and really hard outcomes like death. So he looked at things like death, look cardiovascular disease like heart attacks, and what he found repeatedly is that the people that got more sun exposure, they died less, and they died less of heart disease and other kinds of really important causes of death, like stroke and these kinds of diseases. And for the longest time, we've been told to avoid the sun for risk of skin cancer. Yet what Professor Weller's studies have shown, and the most recent one has just been published, was that the people who got more UV light and they lived closer to the equator, who lived further south, they actually had, again, less, they died of less of all causes, and they actually died less of skin cancer. So in some studies, the people who have exposed to more sunlight had a slightly higher incidence of different, of both squamous cell, basal cell carcinoma, non-melanoma skin cancer, but they lived longer, even having had that diagnosis. So that is just one way of thinking about how important sunlight is for health and for everyone to be thriving. And another very interesting point that's, again, relevant is that that Scotland is actually imported, and I believe you guys are just getting close to changing this recommendation, but your sun seeking and sun avoidance recommendations were copied from us down in Australia. And the reason why that is such a problem is because the ultraviolet and the sunlight conditions are radically different at the latitude, the northern latitudes. You must be above the, I don't know what latitude you are up there
I don't know either.
Scotland.
I don't know.
But it's well above the 45th latitude, I believe, compared to Australia. And, you know, we are down here with, you know, getting UV indexes of 13, which is incredibly 11, incredibly strong, whereas you simply don't have that much light. And what that means is that people, if they cover up, if they wear sunscreens, if they follow these sun avoidance guidelines, especially if you're natively from Scotland, in the Scottish summer, is that you're going to be depriving your body of the ability to make vitamin D adequately and to derive all these benefits that natural sunlight is offering for health and longevity.
Well, you know, that was a real eye-opener for me, and I must admit I had to take a moment to let that sink in. So I think we might just take a short break right now and let you do the same. Stay tuned for more right after these messages.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
And you're listening to Alchemy 101 with me, JJ, the practical alchemist, and my guest today, Dr. Max Goulhane. We were talking about sun exposure guidelines, and Max went on to explain more.
What it means is that you know, these recommendations stipulate that if the UV index, and again, the UV index is a scale that measures the intensity of UV light, and if the UV index climbs above a 3, then it's advised that people should be wearing hats and sun protection and essentially blocking UV light. The problem with that is that it inactivates the body's natural sun defense and sun protection mechanisms, which are intimately tied with the benefits that sunlight provides. And what I mean by that is, as a fair-skinned person living in the area that your ancestors lived and adapted to, is that you have been given a toolkit to perfectly respond to the amount of UV light in your environment seasonally. And what that looks like, again, for Caucasian people in Scotland, is that throughout the summer, you would have been exposed to natural sunlight throughout the peak summer months, and you would develop an amount of melanin, a small amount of melanin or tan, that would block some of the UV light, but still permit enough to get through to generate UV vitamin D. What would happen is that the skin layers, which is essentially the epidermis of that skin layers, would also thicken, almost like bark on a tree. That is another mechanism to act as a defense against too much ultraviolet light. But what would occur is that you would build up a store in your blood, and then would get stored in the fat tissue, of vitamin D. And then when the winter comes, there's that UV light, the UVB light, which makes vitamin D, essentially disappears because of the angle of the sun in the sky. And the skin that would not be getting as much UV light again becomes thinner. And the tan to some degree would reduce. So that would be the natural process, because you'd be exposed all day, every day to the sun. And that cyclic exposure was what humans and our Homo sapien ancestors developed in response to this high latitude living. And that is very different to, say, a person living in the equator and of African descent. So the problem therefore becomes, if we start messing with this process, then you can't develop enough vitamin D, and you don't get all these benefits that the body needs to operate efficiently. And then you get Glasgow becoming the, you know, heart disease capital of the world, the ischemic heart disease capital of the world. And yes, there's other determinants of cardiovascular disease, social determinants, and ultra-processed food, smoking, etc. But the point is, your skin is pale for a reason. And the reason is so it can make the most of the scarce amount of UV light that is available at that latitude. So covering up and avoiding the sun and wearing sunscreens is the exact opposite thing of what you should be doing in the scarce amount of UV light. And to hammer home the point, the reason why people became pale is because without vitamin D, without these sunlight benefits, life becomes basically it's unable to operate. And anyone who was unable to lose their pigment at that high latitudes quickly was selected against in an evolutionary point of view. So there's just some scientific perspectives on why this sunlight is so important, especially for you as a Scots person living in Scotland.
Well, I am very grateful for you for outlining exactly what goes on, because I think a lot of people really don't understand that. And not wanting to trivialize this, but it did go through my head. You were talking about Glasgow. And of course, there's a thing in Glasgow in the summer called Taps Off. As soon as the sun comes out, people, you know, flock into the parks and take their shirts off and get some sun. It's almost like it's an inbuilt thing that we absolutely crave it. And of course, Brits going abroad for their summer holidays, they're always lying in the sun, just craving that sunshine. So what I'm trying to say is, it's not a stupid thing, although it is a bit, but you can understand the innate need for sunlight that makes people do that.
Yes. And although it might be, yes, the subject of, you know, jokes and a kind of cultural chuckling, there is a deeply embedded physiological reason for that behavior, and it ties to a compound called pro-opio-melanocortin. And, you know, anyone who gets told to avoid the sun can ask their doctor about this compound. But essentially, pro-opio-melanocortin in UV light gets cleaved up into a compound called beta-endorphin. And anyone who's taken an opioid medication or an opiate, like potentially morphine or oxycodone or panadine, any of those, fentanyl, hopefully you haven't taken it, maybe you needed it for an operation, but
never had it.
Any of those are opioid compounds, and they bind to they essentially give us a profound analgesic or pain relieving effect. What happens when you go in ultraviolet light is that your body makes a compound that has essentially the same effect. So nature has actually made you to be addicted to the sun, and that proopio melanocortin gene is 500 million years old. So it existed in, you know, these ancient coelacanth fishes. That is how critical ultraviolet light is to mammalian and you know, reptilian as well, life. So, and when you see people in Glasgow in summer with their shirts off, yes, it might look a bit uncouth, but know that it's their biology is rewarding them for doing that by making this compound.
It's extraordinary. I didn't think that this interview would go this way. I have to say, I didn't think we'd be talking about people taking their shirts off in Scottish cities in the summer. But it makes sense to me now. It absolutely makes sense. Yeah. And then, so what about sunscreens? Because often we're told that we should lather ourselves with sunscreen. I mean, what does that do for us?
So sunscreens are, there's a couple of different strategies in terms of the market for sunscreens. There's chemical sunscreens and there's more of these sunblocks. They work in two different ways. Chemical sunscreens have chemicals in them, and those chemicals are ones like a homosalate, oxybenzone. I'm not sure if in Europe they still have oxybenzone in your sunscreens, but what they do is they sit in the skin and they absorb ultraviolet light and therefore prevent that ultraviolet light from penetrating into the layers of the skin and therefore having any biological effect. The other types of sunblock contain things like zinc dioxide and titanium dioxide that act more of as a physical barrier to sunlight. So the issue and the fundamental issue here is that, one, you're preventing that ultraviolet light from having its beneficial effects. And we talked about ultraviolet B briefly in terms of vitamin D production, but it's also needed for that POMC, that proopio melanocortin. And proopio melanocortin has this myriad of beneficial effects and effects on how the body's hormonal systems work. One of them, interestingly, is involved in appetite suppression. And there's a direct pathway between the stimulation of POMC by UV light and the suppression of appetite, meaning the more UV light you get, the less hungry you are, and the more you are, your body is essentially able to regulate its body composition and body weight at the level of the hypothalamus. The other benefits of ultraviolet light include nitric oxide, and that is, again, was discovered or partly discovered by Professor Weller. And what he found was that exposure to ultraviolet A light essentially releases a compound in our blood vessels that relaxes the blood vessels. So conditions like hypertension, high blood pressure, in many ways, and yes, it's a multifactorial process, there's things like insulin resistance is also at play, but can be thought of, in hypertension in many ways can be thought of as sunlight deficiency and a UVA deficiency. So when we wear sunscreens, we are robbing ourselves of the opportunity to have these important to make these photochemical products and to allow these fundamental photobiological processes from occurring in our skin. And that's what the sunscreen is doing. And it all is also preventing us from building up that tolerance that I talked about, which is the kind of bark-like effect on the skin, which is the keratinization of that epidermis, to use medical speak, and to build up melanin. Because those responses are what allow us to harness more UV light and more sunlight without burning. So the essence of the sunscreen issue is that it's depriving us of the opportunity to benefit from the sun. The question, I'm going to anticipate a question that you might ask, is that when, if any, would it be appropriate to wear them?
Right.
And the answer would be If you are in a situation of massively high UV light that is disproportionate for your skin type, so say that you went down to equatorial Africa, JJ, then rather than wear sunscreens and bake in a high UV index that you have no business being in, you would be best to be in the shade. And I like to say that the shade is the best sunscreen because it's not manipulating the wavelengths of light that our body is interpreting. It is simply allowing us to exist without doing that, and therefore maintaining some degree of coherence that the body is able to respond to in a physiologically appropriate way.
That is so interesting. I haven't worn sunscreen for so many years and usually cover up if I feel my skin might burn. I do like the idea of shade being the best form of sunscreen, though. Which got me on to the question of sunglasses. And we'll hear what Dr. Max Gulhane had to say about that after we've heard these messages from our station sponsors. Back right after this.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
And you're listening to Alchemy 101 here on UK Health Radio, the world's number one talk health radio station. I'm JJ, the practical alchemist, and with me today is Dr. Max Gulhane, talking about decentralized health and sunlight in particular. We talked about sunscreen before the break, but what about sunglasses?
Yes, so the skin and the eyes are, and the eyes particularly, are the most important organ for the reception of light signals. And, you know, they've been variously described as, you know, the eye's been described as, it's a neuroendocrine organ. And that's a big fancy word in medical speak of essentially describing the fact that the eye is an organ that takes an extension of the brain that senses light and translates that into hormonal signals. And it does that through a bunch of very unique protein compounds called non-visual photoreceptors. And to explain it simply, your eye is acting as both a camera and a detector, meaning that you have a camera function, which is the rods and the cones are forming images that they can tell me that JJ has got a plant sitting in her living room.
Yeah.
Can tell me, you know, there's a tiger on the horizon, but they also have a detector function and they're detecting specifically different wavelengths of light, and different proteins can detect different wavelengths. The most important one for our circadian rhythm and our 24-hour clock is one that detects blue light. And that blue light detector, those blue light detectors exist in a small number of these, what are called intrinsically photosensitive retinal ganglion cells. Big word, again, it's not important. What's important is that when we cover our eyes from natural solar signals, we are shoving a big spanner in the works of our circadian biology and in the works of a range of other photobiological effects in the body. So what does that look like? It means, say you go out, you wear these UV 400 sunglasses, which block light up to 400 wavelengths. So they essentially block out all UV light. UVA has a role in the synthesis of neurotransmitters like dopamine and serotonin. We also need that ultraviolet A light to generate melatonin, which is that hormone that gets released into our circulation a couple of hours after a nightfall to really trigger the sleep response. So this UV light is key. And UVB, again, we talked about pro-opioid melanocortin, that is a critical pathway. So wearing sunglasses, especially early in the morning, is a great way to confuse your body about what is going on in terms of time of day, season of the year, etc. When might you wear sunglasses? Well, look, if you are, you know, on the summit of a Himalayan mountain, if you're on a glacier, if you're on the open ocean. But the point is that that is not an environment that you're adapted to. That is not an environment that you are going to be spending a lot of time in. So we're talking about daily life here. And my point is that they're not indicated in daily life if you are living in an environment that is congruent with your ancestral past.
Sunglasses have been made to be so cool.
The other point I'll quickly make is that the perception of light through the eye influences the skin's response to the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And meaning that if you are wearing sunglasses, but you are in strong sunlight and you have your skin exposed, then you are essentially hamstringing your body's ability to rapidly adapt to, from a skin point of view, to the ambient light in the environment. Right. And you're also sending a discordant message, an incongruent message between the skin and the eyes about the environment. So it's anecdotally and mechanistically and anecdotally increasing your susceptibility to sunburn if you're wearing sunglasses routinely, because the most important light sensing organ is not able to send a coherent signal via some of these those melanocortin compounds to rapidly allow your skin to darken in response to UV light exposure.
That is so interesting. It really is so, so interesting. And now I noticed on your website, you talk about developing a callus, if you like, a sort of sun callus. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So that is referring to what I mentioned a little bit earlier, which is that there's a host of natural reactions. It can also be thought of as a human photoprotective response. It's what happens to the skin on exposure to ultraviolet light, and that is essentially beneficial. The process of defending and engendering a response and a defensive response to ultraviolet light involves that thickening of that keratinocyte layer. And again, an interesting point of how this works is these layers of skin cells get essentially shed like bark, and they actually die. And what the role that plays is that those dead cells can both act, they both act as a physical barrier for the skin to prevent bacterial infection and cuts, mostly bacteria and any infection sitting on that skin layer. But the dead cells actually absorb ultraviolet light. And if they potentially generate a mutation, because ultraviolet light is mutagenic, meaning it does do damage to the DNA, any skin cell that has collected UV damage and potentially could become cancerous gets shed. It gets like an elevator and it gets pushed off the top. So that form of response, that keratinocyte layer, that skin cell layer, is one of the elegant ways that we've developed a response to the sun. And that's kind of the basis behind that idea of a solar callus, because just like a skin callus, which you get from digging holes in the ground with a shovel, it's a sun callus, it's a solar callus. The other critical part of a solar callus or a sun response is melanin. And melanin is produced after by the melanocyte, which is this special cell that sits in the epidermis at the basal layer. And it gets stimulated by these compounds that this proopio melanocortin compound. What it does is it acts as a very potent absorber of ultraviolet light. So what these little granules do is that they sit above the most delicate parts of the skin cells, and they protect the nucleus from ultraviolet light. So they absorb it and they dissipate it as heat. The amazing thing is that this melanin compound has profoundly diverse effects that the centralized medical and health has no understanding of and no recognized appreciation of. These include antioxidant effects to deal with the oxidative stress, particularly of ultraviolet A light, but other forms of that get essentially generated. But it also has an antimicrobial and antifungal effect. It has an effect of chelating and binding heavy metals. And an interesting observation is that there's a study done showing that exposure to particulate pollution upregulates melanin in skin cells, meaning that they're actually binding heavy metals, and it's one way of excreting those heavy metals. But it's also having these a very, very fundamental, essentially quantum biological process, which is involving the generation of free electrons, melanin is in with its interactions in water. So melanin is a form of ability to generate free energy, and is why one reason why we are why it's so important to this that sunlight exposure is so important, because it's simply a way of powering the body that is independent of food consumption. And chronic disease, which we mentioned earlier, again, I don't want to get too complex for your audience, but it's fundamentally an energy problem. And when you get a brownout, you know, a blackout is when the lights turn off, but a brownout is when the energy dims and the lights start dimming. When you get a brownout in your heart, you get heart failure. If you get a brownout in your kidneys, you start getting chronic kidney disease. If you get a brownout in your brain, from a bioenergetic point of view, you get Alzheimer's disease. So the goal of longevity is to really optimize our energy production in our mitochondria of all our organs. And the sun is through melanin, but also through other means, is providing free energy for us to optimize the essential electrical and bioenergetic function of the whole body. So I hope I didn't make that too difficult to understand, but I really want to impress how critical sunlight is for health, and how the current narratives are simply not even in the realm of understanding or communicating how beneficial and how necessary it is.
No, I don't think you made it too complicated at all. And I'm so grateful to you for talking to me about this today, because I think so few people do understand it. I've learned such a lot from speaking with you today as well. Things that I hadn't really realized, maybe hadn't put two and two together, but also I don't have the same scientific background as you do. So it's very difficult for me to do so. But I think that's really beautifully explained why sunlight is so important to us. And I mean, I could go on. I wanted to ask you a bit more about the prevalence of skin cancer, but I think that would take us into a whole other thing. Probably, maybe that's for another time. Maybe we can talk again about that. But I think
I'll only say something very briefly.
Yeah.
And there's a, I'm going to use an inverted commas, an inverted commas paradox.
Okay.
A paradox that needs to be explained. I use the word paradox as a tongue in cheek, because it's only a paradox if we're adopting a centralized approach, which is what we know is that people with melanoma and non-melanoma skin cancers, so melanoma, squamous cell, and basal cell carcinomas, are more likely than those who don't have those conditions to be vitamin D deficient.
Wow.
And we know that vitamin D is generated in the skin, particularly only exclusively on exposure to UVB light. So if the causal pathway between sun exposure and skin cancer, if it was as simple as, you know, A causes B, then you would expect that people who got skin cancer would have high vitamin D levels from being constantly in the sun.
Yeah.
But they don't. We know they don't. And we know that the depth and the size of a basal cell tumors is related to the degree of vitamin D deficiency. We know that people with metastatic melanoma, the severity and the prognosis of their outcome of their melanoma is worse if they are more vitamin D deficient. So that really begs the question, what is going on here, and to what degree is sunlight versus other environmental factors, potentially like artificial light and blue light, playing in this causal pathway of skin cancer? And the final point is that, again, I'll emphasize, to bring it back to Professor Weller's study that was just recently published, which is, if anyone wants to read it, I'd highly recommend reading that study. It's called Higher UV Light Exposure is Associated with Lower All-Cause Mortality in the UK Biobank Cohort. But one of his findings was that the more UV light you got, the lower skin cancer mortality, meaning that if you got more sun, you got skin cancer, you are less likely to die. So that fits with this idea that the higher vitamin D level you are, essentially the more protected you are from developing melanoma and severity in melanoma, which is the most concerning and dangerous skin cancer.
And on that bombshell, that's where we leave it with Dr. Max Gulhane. I'm very glad that I ditched the sunglasses years ago. Fantastic information, though, and I hope you found it enlightening. Now, Dr. Max Gulhane's website is drmaxgulhane.com. That's drmaxgulhane.com. And if you want to learn more about how to improve your health this way, he has two courses, Circadian Reset and Solar Callus. All the details are on his website, so do check those out. Time for me to leave you right now as we're at the end of the show. I've written a blog post about this on my website, thepracticalalchemist.uk, with a link to Max's interview with Professor Richard Weller in it, if that is of interest to you. Do take a look. I'd love to hear what you think. You can message me on Instagram at Practical Alchemist or email me at jj@thepracticalalchemist.uk. Thank you for listening. Join me next time for more Practical Alchemy and more fabulous guests with great information on how to be naturally healthy. Until then, it's goodbye from me and that nightingale.